Hey guys, Mike Verkes from the Second Shift Podcast here to talk to you about PIASE. Back in 1996, I had two certifications to manage, my state license and national registry. That was it. Fast forward 20-some years later, and what I would give to have just two. Between my advanced certifications, ACLS, PALS, PHTLS, you name it, I'm looking at upwards of 10 certifications to manage. That's where PIASE saves my bacon. I simply add my certs, expiration dates, and bam, no more surprises. Take pictures front and back and share those credentials with whoever needs them. With the touch of a button, it's easy. Go to the App Store now for your device and search for PIASE, P-I-A-C-E-T, PIASE. Do it today.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Today's podcast is going to be called Foam Frat Transfusion Confusion Response. Tyler just put out a podcast a couple days ago. I thought it was a good podcast. I did call him on and talk to him about this and just gave him kind of my two cents, but I do applaud him for the podcast. And so this podcast is not a negative response, it's a positive response. And it's just my additional thought process, my additional thinking, and I'm going to kind of throw out some new ideas. I'm going to throw out some data that I know of and see if he has a different response and a different thought process. One of the things I want to start out with is, what are our core indicators in that resuscitation phase in a trauma patient? Obviously, we're talking about packed red blood cells. And Tyler really highlights, I think, very, very well, blood pressure is a very poor indicator. And I think heart rate, if you're looking at heart rate in the wrong way, is probably a poor indicator as well. We know that a patient decompensates at a 30 to 40% blood loss. Well, that's very late. Unless you're hemorrhaging into your pelvis, you have a big vessel laceration, 30 to 40% doesn't happen instantaneously. And if it does, you're probably not going to make it more than a few minutes. So we know a 30 to 40% blood loss is a class 3 blood loss. That's up to 2 liters. And that's what it takes to have a clinical decline in blood pressure. So I have to agree with him that blood pressure is a very poor indicator. I will say, though, and add this, that we do know based on Dave Olvera and Dan Davis's airway data that a systolic less than 80 and an end-tidal CO2 less than 25 in a trauma patient is an impending arrest situation. So I think once you get down that low, I think those are definite core indicators, red flags. But we do know that MAP is a great goal, and we know that in quotations, permissive hypotension, what I don't think is a great word. I like to say, we're maintaining the lowest level of perfusion needed to perfuse our liver, our brain, our heart, other areas of our body. We know that the kidneys usually need around 65, some say 60, to maintain good urine output. But we know our kidneys are really good at shunting blood to other areas. So 60 we know is that core number we hit. Now I will say this, that ATAC guidelines, many trauma centers, many level 1 trauma center trauma surgeons are utilizing a MAP of 50 in a penetrating trauma setting. So if there's penetrating trauma, they will bring that MAP down to 50 just to augment them into the OR. And the thought process is, again, you keep the MAP lower, you keep the perfusion status lower, and this is more of a limited time period. Your patient's not going to bleed as fast, and your patient's not going to decline as fast. So I think to add to that, what makes it very, very difficult in these trauma settings is, what about these traumatic brain injury patients? We know that a MAP needs to be much higher. We know a MAP of 90 is going to be that core number we shoot for in a TBI patient with associated multisystems trauma, because we have to maintain a cerebral perfusion pressure of at least 70. We know that the high end of normal on our ICP is right around 15. So, if we use 20 as that number, assuming that they have a little bit of an elevated ICP, that's where we get that MAP of 90. So that makes it very difficult in a hemorrhaging trauma patient with associated TBI. And we also know that there's no clinical evidence to ever use vasopressors in a trauma setting. And I think they articulate that very well in this podcast, that even in the presence of TBI, we do not use vasopressors whatsoever in trauma. We have to fill the tank. We have to replace the volume. So I think mechanism is number one, looking at the patient, looking at that clinical course, looking at shock index. And I think Tyler highlights this. Look at shock index and really calculate that. That should be your core indicator, is shock index. Do you have a tachycardic patient? What is the heart rate? A tachycardic patient in the presence of shock index versus a bradycardic patient, if you calculate multiple variables, you'll see that a tachycardic patient gives you actually a higher shock index. So you're going to take that heart rate, divide it into that systolic blood pressure, and that is going to elicit a shock index. And we know if it's greater than 0.9, that is an ominous finding. You know, that's where we have to be really worried. What about lactate? We know lactate is a byproduct of cellular respiration. It's a byproduct of cellular glycolysis in the aerobic and anaerobic state, so both aerobic and anaerobic. That means that whether you're in an aerobic or anaerobic state, our body produces lactate. It produces lactate as a biofuel. The reason why we trend lactates is because the more stressed our body is, the more lactate production we have, because that whole process is stimulated by beta 2 receptors that secrete or trigger the secretion of glycogen from the liver. We know that that fires skeletal muscles. We know that causes bronchodilation. So it's all about that sympathetic response. The higher the sympathetic response, the more glycolysis we're going to have, the more ATP we're going to produce, and more lactate we're going to produce. So that's why we look at lactate from that perspective, is how much stress is the body under. One of the things I do want to point out when we look at packed red blood cells, before I get further in this podcast, is about 2 years ago, one of my good friends, Kelly Miller, he was establishing the blood protocol and getting blood on the aircrafts for all the Air Methods Kentucky helicopters. And he was having to, you know, get the data. And so he was able to work with the University of Kentucky, and, you know, they worked together to evaluate about 21 patients that were transfused. Some patients were not transfused, and they were able to track the patients from the scene or from the transferring hospital all the way through the patient care at the University of Kentucky. And I've got some data here that I want to highlight. Again, this isn't a huge sample size. It's only about 21, 22 patients. But there's some significant data points here that I think are profound. The first data point is when you look specifically at patients that were transfused versus not transfused. We know base deficit is the same thing as a negative base excess, and we know that a negative base excess or base deficit is an indication of acidosis. Every hemorrhaging patient is going to become acidotic. That's just an automatic. So based on his data, seen flights that were transfused arrived at the University of Kentucky with a base deficit of 3.3. That would be a base excess of negative 3, right? That's just mildly higher than normal. Seen flights that were not transfused arrived at University of Kentucky with a 9 base deficit. So that would be a negative 9 base excess. That's a pretty big difference, pretty big difference. H&H, so seen flights that were transfused had an H&H on arrival of 13 and 40. So a hemoglobin of 13, hematocrit of 40. Seen flights not transfused were 10 and 31. So again, pretty significant difference. Lactates. Lactates, seen flights transfused, arrival lactate was 3.9. Seen flights not transfused, arrival lactate of 5.28. So I think that really highlights and shows that packed red blood cell administration, utilizing clinical judgment, utilizing mechanism, really does make a difference. Now, we know that when we looked at the proper trial, and we've done a podcast on that, and you looked at 1:1:1 versus 1:1:2, that 24-hour survival was higher in the 1:1:1, but there was no difference at that 30-day discharge. So when we look at blood transfusion protocols, you know, I'll highlight, you know, AMC. AMC's blood transfusion protocol, really, it's this: hypovolemia with acute blood loss. That's it. That's the indication. There's no highlighted guideline of, well, you have to have a systolic of this, you have to have a MAP of this, you have to have a heart rate of this. They really leave it open for the provider, the flight nurse, the flight paramedic, to make that clinical judgment, and I think that that's fantastic. So obviously, you know, we're not going to be able to type and cross, and so we always administer O positive for male patients, O negative for any female patients of childbearing age. You know, O positive will be for females of not childbearing age, but we have to think about childbearing age. I know physicians that have told me stories where they've given positive pregnancy tests to 55, 57-year-old females. So I think on the female side, it's probably safest up until that, you know, probably 60-year-old range to always give, you know, those females that O negative. So when we look at the PAMPER trial was a trial that was just finished, took place over the last 3 years or so, maybe 4 years. This was a randomized trial where they looked at patients in the air medical environment. And the trial essentially, if we just get down to the nuts and bolts, there was a total of 501 total patients randomized at the end. N equals 230 patients in the plasma arm. There was a 23.2% mortality rate in that plasma arm. So that is a total of 52 out of the 230 patients. So 52 patients died. When you compare that to the standard resuscitation arm, N equaled 271 patients, and that is with normal saline, and there was a 33% mortality rate. So out of the 271 patients, 89 of those patients died. So that's a 10% increase in mortality in the standard resuscitation arm. So is fresh frozen plasma the answer? You know, I don't know if we should be doing a study showing a randomized, you know, difference in blood products, you know, looking at Patrick blood cells versus plasma. You know, I know in the past there's been highlighted papers that look at specifically, you know, adverse reactions to plasma administration. But when you look at plasma versus standard resuscitation, there's definitely a big improvement in overall survival. So I think that's huge. I think the key is anything is better than normal saline. You know, that is atherogenic saltwater drowning. We definitely don't want to do that. The last little section I want to highlight is TXA, and I think they talk about TXA in the podcast and highlight some different aspects. I think my two cents on TXA is I think TXA is good. I don't think that we should withhold TXA. I think, you know, obviously patients that have other contraindications to fibrinolytic therapy, we have to, you know, withhold that. Obviously, if the injury is greater than 3 hours, we want to withhold that. But really, when you look at TXA guidelines and administering TXA, your protocol may be very, very specific, where you have to have a systolic less than 90, or you have to have a heart rate greater than 110. You know, when I flew for Air Methods all those years, you know, we have in the guidelines that, you know, you may have a systolic less than 90 in hemorrhaging patients. You may have a pulse rate greater than 110, but there's not a definitive true number that you have to target on. It's just look for these different aspects. And so again, some protocols are very, very vague. They really allow you to critically think and use your index of suspicion, and other protocols, as everybody knows, or maybe very, very specific. So I think that that is very broad based on where you're working and your medical director. Again, I think as long as you're within that 3 hour mark, you have clinical signs of mechanism, you have the same signs that of, you know, blood loss, I think you give TXA. I think the 1 gram over 100, in 100 mils over 10 minutes, that is the standard. I know Tyler talks about, you know, just a slow IV push, and I think that that's fine as well. And I think he brings up some good points based on what the author has said on that study. So I think in general, you know, I wanted to highlight some things on this podcast. I wanted to touch on the PAMPER trial. I think a lot of aircrafts are going to where they're pulling off some of the blood, and they're not carrying as much packed red blood cells. They're going to start carrying FFP. We know that packed red blood cells have problems. We know that packed red blood cell administration in that massive transfusion protocol, again, that is classified in most settings as total blood product administration of greater than 6 units. We know packed red blood cells have citrate. That citrate encapsulates the 2,3-DPG within a few weeks. And it's not that it destroys the 2,3-DPG, it encapsulates it. So when we give massive transfusion, we know 2,3-DPG is all about offloading oxygen off the hemoglobin. And so we're repairing, replacing O2 carrying capacity. The hemoglobin is uptaking all this oxygen, which is great, but when it needs to offload it to the tissues, there's nothing to facilitate that. So it takes the body about 8 hours to actually unencapsulate that 2,3-DPG to where it actually can start working, where you can have proper offloading. A full 24 hours after transfusion before you have all the 2,3-DPG available for, you know, offloading that oxygen. So that is one of the problems that we see in massive transfusion. We also know that there's been a study related to vasopressin, that vasopressin and cortisol is completely destroyed within a few hours of citrate being added to packed red blood cells. We know that we have calcium and magnesium problems to where you have, you know, those low states. So there's definitely problems with packed red blood cells. But I think in our setting, packed red blood cell administration is a gold standard. I think we really should be pushing this. You know, we're not giving 6 units of blood products. I think that's where the trauma center then can switch over. I think many trauma centers are now going to, or considering going to, whole blood. I think that is what we should be doing. But we know that, you know, we really lose a lot of ability to take the different components of that whole blood and use it for other things. So there's a shortage. So I definitely think all in all, we have a lot of amazing tools available. If you're using packed red blood cells, I think that's great. If you're using plasma, I think that's great as well. If you have both at your disposal, I think that's even better. If you have TXA as well, I think you give them all. And so I just wanted to highlight this. This is the foam frat transfusion confusion response. Until next time, I will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.